Good evening. My name is DJ Schneeweis. I'm the Consul General of Israel here in Toronto. I was born in Australia, made Aliyah 25 years ago, so I don't sound like the Israeli consul, I know, but I promise you I am that guy, okay? Okay? You do not have an imposter here with you this evening. It's great to have joined up with Torah in Motion to have Ari here to speak. I'm really happy that so many people came out tonight to listen to him. I know, having heard him and having spoken to him over the last couple of days, he's a great speaker. You're going to have a great time. I want to congratulate Torah in Motion for the work they do, and it's an honor and pleasure to partner up with Rabbi Jay and his team and to be part of their efforts. I just want to share one thought with you this evening, as the Consul General. Part of my work here is to talk about Israel and to talk about it to many different different audiences and people. And there are different messages, but I find that within the Jewish world, one of the things that I feel sort of compelled to say is that, I'll tell it like this. Often many people look at Israel as a kind of inheritance, like a painting they inherit from their grandmother. It's a beautiful thing. They hang it on the wall. At the same time, maybe they don't like the frame so much, or they don't even like the colors of the painting or the design, but they know it's a family heirloom, and so they hang it nevertheless, and it's an inheritance, and it's something important, and they tell their children that it's important. But it's, an object, sort of almost distant, not really something that's part of them. And my sense of what Israel is, and this is my story, I came to it as a young person who grew up in a community not dissimilar to this, is that Israel is not a painting that we've inherited from our grandparents, but rather it is the national canvas of the Jewish people, which is still being painted. It is still being created. And it's a canvas on which every single one of us can bring his own story and his own expression and make his contribution. And if we conceive of Israel as that great national canvas of our people, then there's still so much more that each and every one of us can do in order to fashion that campus, to design it, to make it what we feel it needs to be. And so as we listen to Ari Sasha this evening, I just want to leave you with the thought that this rocket scientist, this guy who's involved in defending the people of Israel and in carrying Israel forward to the absolute forefront of technological innovation in the entire world, that your son, your daughter, your grandson, your granddaughter could be the next Ari Sasha. It is a great national endeavor that we are all part of, and it's a great honor to represent that great endeavor here this evening, and I wish us all a wonderful evening. Shavua Tov.
Good evening. Just Shavua Tov, just a sec. Anybody who knows me, and there's a couple of people in the audience who have known me in a younger form, know that I have great difficulty keeping still. So it would be lovely if I could have some video here. What do I have to do? It is on. Oh, this must have fallen out. You got it?
There we go.
All right, good. Excellent. Ooh, that looks... It's kind of making me ill just looking at it. But let's pretend it's not making us ill just looking at it. I'm here to talk about Israel missile defense, truth and not truth, and give you a bit of background on who I am. You know what? First of all, two things. This particular evening is what we call off-the-record evening. I would appreciate it, unless you are very closely related to me, that you do not film this evening. And if you do film this evening, then I would request that you do not upload it to the internet, nor write anything on the internet that has my name on it. This is for reasons of security, and it's also for reasons of the fact that this evening is off the record and allows me to speak my mind. I work at Rafael. It's a company in Israel. We're sort of like a missile house. Missiles are us. And we make things like Iron Dome and David Sling and all these things that are out there protecting Israelis. And the neat thing is when you work in this, you kind of compare what you do and with what they write about. And sometimes it's like, whew, it's a whole world of stuff out there that that there's a world of difference what they write and what you do. And what I'm here tonight to show you is what Iron Dome really is, because anybody who hasn't been in a cave for the last month knows that Iron Dome was the hero of the last war, knows that Iron Dome has pretty much changed the way people live in Israel. And I'll show you later, it's pretty much changed the fabric of Israeli society, for better or for worse. And the question is, what can an insider tell you? So that's what I'm going to do tonight, give you guys an idea. What I want to tell you is that I have shown this slide in New York City 7 times, in Atlanta for lunch, in Florida for dinner, in Chicago 3 times, and yesterday once. And on the bottom of the slide, it says, Iron Dome in a nutshell, Kwanzaa 2012. And one person in the entire North America has actually noticed it. Some guy in Atlanta with big eyes. So I want to thank you guys for being part of taking part of my psychological test. You've all failed. We are surrounded in Israel by friends who want to share the love, as it were. Friends who just can't get enough of us and want to show us how much they love us. And they're all around. They're in Lebanon, and they're in Iran, and they're in Syria. But the friends that interest us, at least the friends that interested us a month ago in the last war, I call it a war. Some people call it an operation. Some people call it an escalation. I love that word. It's an escalation. It's not a war. Okay, fine. So in the last war, it was the people in Gaza who were interesting us. Now, when you want to kill somebody, the best way to do it is to punch him until he dies. But what if he's far away from you? So then you take a grenade, and you throw the grenade at him, and the grenade blows up, and he dies. What happens if he's too far away for that bomb you're throwing to do something to him? What you do is you take that bomb, and you stick it inside a metal tube, and then you take a rocket motor, and using a rocket science term, you shtup the rocket motor at the bottom of that metal tube. You attach a couple of fins, and you have a rocket. It goes up, it goes down, it goes boom, and everybody's happy. So in the beginning, our buddies out there in Gaza, they had trouble getting raw material. I mean, it's difficult getting raw material. You need the metal tubing, and to make the bombs, you need the thing that goes boom inside. You need sugar, and you need fertilizer and other stuff like that. But they had trouble getting really good stuff because you're in Gaza, and you're surrounded by everybody. Here you're surrounded by the Egyptians. Here you're surrounded by the Israelis. We got a blockade. So they got problems. So what they did was they would make their little things called Qassam rockets. What's a Qassam rocket? Really, really primitive. You could make it in the confines of your own bathroom. Guys would go upstairs. Honey, where are you going? I'm going to the bathroom. What are you going to do in there? Not going to tell you. Closes the door. Da-da-da. She hears bang, 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 bang. Is everything okay? Yeah, really good dinner last night. Okay, bang, 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 bang. And he comes out, and he takes this Qassam rocket, and he's kind of concealing it underneath his jalabiya sort of thing. And a jalabiya is like a kittel. And then he takes out... And then he gets to where he wants to go, and he takes out that Qassam, and he puts it on a launcher. But before he launches the Qassam, he puts on a ski mask, because I have never seen a picture of an Arab launching a rocket without wearing a ski mask. Apparently, it's part of the required religious garb. So he would put on the ski mask, and they would launch these Qassams. Now, because these Qassams were so primitive, and they really were primitive, they didn't go very far, and they didn't carry very much bombs. We call warhead. Warhead's the thing that goes boom. And their warheads are very, very small. And they would launch it at places like Sderot and Netivot, places that people had never really heard of, and most people in the decision-making area part of the country really weren't too concerned about. So that's a horrible thing to say, isn't it? There were people in Sderot, and there's about 1,000 people there, and a rocket would fall once every couple of days or weeks, and they didn't do too much damage because they weren't supposed to do too much damage. Let's just set the ground rules right here. Whenever someone from Gaza fires a rocket into Israel, he does so in order to kill an Israeli. The fact that these rockets don't fall and don't kill, statistically they have a very low chance of doing any kind of damage, is because they're imprecise, it's because they're small, it's because Kadosh Baruch Hu helps us out, who knows, even without Iron Dome. But when they are successful, then they are guilty of nothing less than premeditated murder. It's the same thing as walking into a crowded room and firing a very imprecise gun. If you miss anybody, fine. But if you hit somebody with that pistol, then you have tried to kill him and you have been successful. So we have to really be cognizant of that fact. These people are not mischievous. These people are deadly. Okay, so that was Gaza, and that was nice. But then Sinai changed. Sinai Desert over here turned into something we call in Rafael Al-Qaedistan. Al-Qaedistan means that the Egyptian army lost control of Sinai. Forces of Al-Qaeda essentially took over, pockets of Al-Qaeda, and it became a no-man's land in Sinai, such that if you look at the bottom of Sinai, which isn't here, that goes all the way down to the Red Sea, and Sinai became a very big port of call for people that were interested in smuggling larger rockets into Gaza. Now, they would get their rockets, big rockets from Iran and Algeria, and I'll talk about that in a minute, but They'd bring the rockets up here and they'd smuggle it into here through what's called the Philadelphia Corridor or the Rafiah border crossing, and they'd smuggle it in tunnels. Now, when you think of people smuggling in tunnels, you're thinking of television shows where guys are trying to get out of jail with a spoon, and eventually they can take their comb with them because their tunnel is big enough for them to crawl through and carry their comb. This is not the kind of tunnels that we're talking about over here. The kind of tunnels we're talking about over here are large enough for vehicles to drive through. They can carry with them large rockets on board the vehicles. They're dug with professional digging equipment, of which they lack none of in Gaza. These tunnels are closer in shape and size to the Lincoln Tunnel and the Holland Tunnel than they are to the tunnel that you're thinking about with the guy with the spoon. So they got these new things in there, and they're called grads, Katyushas, grad 20, grad 40. These things can go far. Now, where do you get these things from? They can get them from essentially two kinds of places. No. They don't get them from Russia because the Russians are wonderful people who love us all. And I appreciate if you guys can hold off the questions until the end. That'd be great. Where do they get these things from? They get them from one of two places. They can get them from sovereign countries like Iran or Algeria, for instance. If you're going to get them from one of these sovereign countries, and you're going to get it with all the bells and whistles, you're going to get it with it's going to have all the bubble wrap and the money back guarantee, and it's going to have the navigation package and heated seats. And those, but you're going to pay a pretty penny for these things. It's going to cost you about $3,000 a pop. For a Katyusha. You can also get a Katyusha in places that I like to call Mustafa's House of Katyushas. And what is Mustafa's House of Katyushas? It's like one of these back door places, usually on the second floor of a garage in Gaza, and you walk up the steps, and you open the door, and there's this guy, and he's sitting there tinkering over a Katyusha, and the kind of labor is what we in Israel derogatorily call Arab labor. And it's really, you know, it's not that great. The paint's falling off and the arc welding isn't really, really good. But you know what? It goes up, it goes down, it goes boom, and it kills Jews. It's lovely. And it costs less. At Mustafa's House of Katyushas, you can buy a Katyusha rocket for $1,000 less on Black Friday. And Amazon is having a sale on them right now as we speak. Now, the nice thing about these rockets is that they can hit far places. They can hit places like Beersheba, Ashkelon, and Ashdod. And if you look at this circle, which this area over here is approximately where those Katyushas can fall, there are more than 500,000 people that live there. And they started regularly, they, meaning our friends in Gaza, started firing on these people regularly a couple of years ago. And their lives had totally changed. I remember people in Beersheba had no idea how close they were to Gaza until the rockets started falling. All of a sudden, Beersheba's border country. But there was more than that. We knew that they had in Gaza things that could travel further. And when I was allowed, finally, security allowed me to add them here, I added like another line over here. It's about 70 kilometers out. But I couldn't say what it was. But everybody knew about it. Because everybody knew that they were firing them into the ocean. So I was allowed to call them advanced threats. In Hebrew, advanced threats. So these advanced threats, how far did they go? They went 75 or 70 kilometers. But after the last war, the advanced threats got a name. And that name was Fajr 5. As in,
Kipat Barzel, you kill my Fajr, prepare to die.
Now, what is the neat thing about the Fajr 5? That was going around. There were all these Kipat Barzel jokes going around. When you're fighting, things that usually wouldn't be funny are actually quite funny. Now, what's the difference between a Fajr 5 and a Katyusha? A Fajr 5 is not just a Katyusha that goes longer. It doesn't just go 70 kilometers or 75 kilometers. A Katyusha holds 40 pounds or 18. You guys are Canadians. Sorry there. I'm going to start talking about kilos. 18 kilos of TNT. What can 18 kilos of TNT do? It can put a mean crimp in your afternoon. There's a girl in Moreshet where I live, and she's doing Shirut Lumi. Her parents live in Be'er Sheva. Her mother was on the radio. No, mother's on the radio. Why is she on the radio? Because they live in Be'er Sheva, and the alarm went off, and these people did what they're supposed to do. They went into their mamad, a mamad being a reinforced steel room that all Israeli houses have to have since 1991. Slammed the door. They heard a boom. They thought one of these things landed across the street. Opened the door, and whoosh, they were in Kansas. There was like nothing there. There was a house of 2,000 square feet that was taken down by a Katyusha. So the rule of thumb is that 18 kilo of TNT is going to take down a house. A Fajr does not hold 18 kilo of TNT. A Fajr holds 175 kilo of TNT. Katyusha is about this thick. A Fajr is about twice as thick. Fajr holds 175 kilo of pure tender loving. And what will happen when a Fajr hits a building, as it did in Rishon, near the end of the war, 12-story building, knocked off, shaved off the entire four stories of the upper stories, and caused major structural damage to the lower stories. So a Fajr is going to cause a major, major crimp in your afternoon. And for the time being, this is what they're firing at us. And all of a sudden, it's not just places down there in the south where people go on Hanukkah. By the way, these places are full of people on Hanukkah. In Israel, it's like wartime, war's over, okay, time to go. And Hanukkah, we were all over the place. We were down here, we were down here. It's like the war. Israel has an amazing capability to turn on and turn off war mode. But all of a sudden, you have places like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and it's like the whole country over here that's subject to rocket fire. And truth be told, this line over here that I drew is really the Beit Hillel line. Like this is the Makil line. The Beit Shammai line actually goes out to over here. It covers essentially all the way to the Dead Sea. Now, our friends from Lebanon, I mean, they can hit all the way down to here. And remember how I said that Sinai is Al-Qaeda-stan? So they're launching from all the way down here. And they're hitting places like Mitzpe Ramon. And they even hit Eilat. And apparently what happened was someone tried shooting Eilat. And he overshot Eilat. And he went all the way into Aqaba in Jordan. I wonder who paid for that. Who shot that weapon? Steve, you're in trouble. So Steve killed somebody in Aqaba. So actually the entire country of Israel is subject to rocket fire except for one small place. In this cleft over here by the Dead Sea, there is a cave. And the cave has its entrance facing the Dead Sea. And that is the one place where rockets cannot enter. Don't try to find it because I have located some of our stuff there in case things get hot and hairy. So that's what we're doing in Israel. Now, what are we up against? Well, like I said, this picture of a Fajr 5 is one of my favorites. Why is it one of my favorites? Because usually when you look on the internet for pictures of these things, so they're showing pictures of this Fajr 5 was launched by the Algerians against the Afghanistanis or something like that. This particular Fajr 5 is leaving Gaza International Airport all the way over to Israel. This is tender love that is being provided by the Hamas to Israel. This was taken in Israel. Here's your Katyushas over here, which I spoke about. Here's a mortar, very, very insidious. What is a mortar? A mortar is just a grenade. A grenade, you take a grenade, you shtup a fin on it. We're doing a lot of shtupping in the rocket science world. And you drop it into a tube, you pull a string, boom, up goes the grenade, down goes the grenade, and it kills people. In the last war, almost as many people were killed by mortars as were killed by grads because they're just so insidious. Now, I always show this because it's a feel-good slide for me. I briefed close to half of Congress, and I was somewhat surprised by Congress's inability to understand simple things like numbers. So I said, you know, this 107 millimeter, this is not affecting the Israelis because they don't launch at it from Gaza, but they do launch these things at American forward operating bases in places like Iraq. Where?
Iraq.
Okay, fine. So you launch it from Iraq. So he says, well, how big are these things? I said, well, they're 80 centimeters long. And I get this glassy-eyed stare, and I'd be asked questions like, how many degrees Fahrenheit in 80 centimeters? So I say, okay, fine. So it's like 32 inches long? Still that glassy-eyed stare. So after the third or fourth time that I briefed these guys, I started adding that little thing on the bottom that kind of helps them understand how big these things are. That's pretty small, isn't it? So, you know, laugh, laugh, but in July of 2011, this was captured on a UAV. The fellow pulls up his pickup truck right next to a forward operating base in the middle of Baghdad. He came up to the perimeter fence. He was wearing a jalabiya, pulled one of these things out from under his jalabiya. Remember, that's an Arab kittel. And he pulled out a launcher. What's a launcher? A launcher is essentially a glorified coat hanger, which is about two-thirds the size. Set the rocket on the launcher. He aimed it point blank at the forward operating base, fired it into the forward operating base, and about 12 seconds later, five U.S. Marines were dead. These things can be extremely deadly. The only reason that these rockets, even in the 2006 war, were hitting open fields and were hitting the sea instead of hitting shopping malls or where my daughter goes to kindergarten is because of dumb luck or Kadosh Baruch Hu or a combination of the two. So this is what we're up against. And because of the threat, we were tasked to do something about it. And this was in 2006. Now, since Iron Dome has been so successful in the last war, everybody wants to be the father of Iron Dome. There are millions of paternity suits out there right now for Iron Dome. I myself was forced to submit a hair sample to prove that I was on the team working on Iron Dome. Now, why? Because when Iron Dome was going up, not everybody wanted Iron Dome to go up. They thought that Iron Dome was a terrible idea, and for a number of reasons. Some people had political reasons, some people had business reasons, and some people just didn't believe we could do it. We were taken to court, the Controller General got angry at us, and essentially the idea was, wait a minute, you guys are going to take a rocket and shoot down another rocket? You're going to hit a bullet with a bullet? That's science fiction. Why don't you try something more down to earth, like a laser? Okay, fine. So Rafael had been developing a laser with Northrop Grumman, and they said, why don't you use the laser? Because we said, well, that's a great idea, but there's two small problems. Problem number one, when you fire the laser, it kind of emits a noxious cloud of gas. They said, well, aren't you using that laser in the north? You can emit whatever kind of gases you want. No, we're going to stick this laser in Tel Aviv. What? Not in my backyard. So because we didn't want to have noxious, poisonous gas in Tel Aviv, that and above, lasers don't work when it's raining. That's okay if we could reach an agreement with our enemies that they would only fire at us when it's sunny. But because we are not yet at that level, they can fire at us also when it's raining, can't use a laser. They said, wait a minute. Okay, laser's out. But what do the Americans do? The Americans do everything well. The Americans do everything great. Why don't we emulate the Americans? I never heard an Israeli ask that question before. So why don't we emulate the Americans? What do the Americans use? Well, the Americans use to defend their forward operating bases, they use something called Vulcan Phalanx. Vulcan Phalanx, just the word, causes a surge of testosterone in most people. Just hearing that word, Vulcan Phalanx, it's a really good word. What does it do? It's a cannon. So you think of people, what do they think of cannon? They think of Captain Jack Sparrow and his cannon. No, a cannon is not something where Quigley puts in a ball and pulls a string and up it goes. A cannon that we're talking about, Vulcan Phalanx, is something that fires 1,000 shells a minute in the sky. It sounds like this. Like this. So what does it do? After it spits into the sky, all these shells explode such that you have a curtain of steel. Wow. That would be a good name for a defense of some team from Pennsylvania. You have a curtain of steel in the sky, and the incomings go through the curtain of steel, and the idea is that they get torn to shreds. And this indeed does happen nearly 25% of the time. But the problem is not the fact that it doesn't shoot it down. Another problem is that what goes up must come down, even in the Middle East. That curtain of steel is not going to stay up there ad infinitum. That curtain of steel eventually is going to fall to the ground, and it's going to be a carpet of steel. Now, Mela, a carpet of steel. I know, my honey, watch out when you cross, there's a carpet of steel in front of the house. Just watch out for the steel. Don't you got to put on shoes? No, it's worse than that, because in that carpet of steel, there's about 10% duds, which means 10% of the things you fired did not go off in the air, and 10% of what you're going to step on is step on a crack, break your mother's... it's going to put a real major crimp. You are not going to go out and buy milk unless you can see where you're walking. So since we cannot afford to have this situation in Tel Aviv, they said, okay, can't do the laser, can't do the cannon. We're going to do the hitting the missile with the missile. And what they did was they turned to Rafael, as we had the best proposal at the time, and they said, look, we are going to throw tons of money at you. This is a program of national importance. We're going to come back 3 years from now, and you're going to have a working system. Now, understand, 3 years to have a working system is a ludicrous request. Things don't happen in 3 years. 3 years is usually when we have our first successful design review. 3 years is how long it took us. We started working in December of 2007, and in April of 2011, we were already defending people. We had already shot down rockets that were headed for Ashkelon. How did we do it? Well, there's a whole slide presentation of how he did it, but very, very quickly, when your underpants are on fire, you're going to work really, really hard to put them out. And this is what was happening. There's part of Israel on fire. Every day that we did not come up with a working solution, there are people out there who stood to die. And the Hamas did not wait for us to get this thing ready before they fired at us. They fired at us regularly during the whole development. And every time they fired and we hadn't finished developing, there was a tremendous feeling of that we missed something. How long does it usually take to develop a missile system? Between 10 and 15 years. So 3.5 years is simply ludicrous. How did we do it? There's a lot of hard work. And something that I can tell you is that usually when my wife Tova asks me what I'm doing, I'm really not allowed to tell her a program I'm working on. I'm working on a program. Yeah, really. And if I can tell the people that I don't like, all she needs to know is the people that I don't like. That's good enough. That'll keep us going discussion-wise, at least until it's time to go to sleep. But I can't tell her what you guys don't laugh at anything. And I can't tell her what program I'm working on, especially unless the program is an unclassified program. So right now I'm working on Iron Dome. It's already an unclassified program. She's allowed to know about it. But if we're working a Shushu program, can't tell her that. In Iron Dome, when we were developing it, not only was Iron Dome Iron Dome was a secret program, there was a lot of data that we had to make sure didn't get out, and there was a lot we couldn't tell the media. But we were encouraged to tell our families what we were working on. The point being that if you're going to go to work before the sun rises, and you're going to come home long after the sun sets, and you got to spend your days looking over your shoulder to explain to your wife and children why you're working on something that you can't tell them about, you're going to have great difficulty doing your job. But if your family is not only cognizant of what you're doing, and your family is part of what you're doing, then they will push you to work. They become part of the national cause to help you work. Case in point, Sukkos, last year, Rafael had an open house. Took my kids to the open house, and happened to be that they had an Iron Dome launcher. And this was, we were late that year, uncharacteristically, for sending out Shana Tova cards. And my kids had a great idea. Let's all stand next to this Iron Dome launcher as a family and have someone take a picture of us. And lo and behold, we did. And that became our Shana Tova cards. Now, if I was working on a weapon, which I'd been working on earlier, which flies 100 miles and goes through a window and kills 500 Arabs simultaneously, oh, Abba, let's take a picture on that. My kids never did that because it's kind of, you know, gross. But the kids felt a huge connection to the system. My kids still feel a huge connection to the system. A huge amount of pride, a huge amount of having taken part in something that is saving lives. So that's essentially how we did it. Now, what do we do? First of all, we do the short-range rockets. Okay? We're only doing the rockets that don't go far. We gotta work when it's raining. We gotta take care of a city. We gotta blow up the warhead. What do you mean gotta blow up the warhead? Remember that warhead over there that they got in there? Well, 1991, we had the pleasure of being cannon fodder for Saddam Hussein, and what happened was we stood. Israeli hubris said that if you stand like this, they will not fire because you're Israeli. But they did. So the Americans sent in Patriot missiles, Patriot batteries from Germany, and the Patriot at the time was the most technologically advanced way to shoot down airplanes. And they figured, well, if it can shoot down an airplane, it can shoot down a missile. Wrong. Why? Because what would happen was the missiles coming in, and the Patriot goes up in the sky, and it's looking, where's the missile? Where's the missile? I'm going to find it. And it opens its eyes, and there's the Scud coming in. It's got to hit it, and it sort of grits its teeth together, and it's missile-ish teeth, and it runs out to the Scud, and it, bang, hits the Scud in the fattest part of the Scud. Which part was that? It was the rocket motor. Well, what happens when you hit the Scud in the rocket motor is that you push the Scud off of its course. So instead of hitting Tel Aviv, it hit Ramat Gan. Big deal! I don't think the people in Iraq knew there was a difference between Tel Aviv and Ramat Gan. If it hits Tel Aviv, or it hits Ramat Gan, or it hits Givatayim, or even if it hits Petach Tikva, they don't care. As long as it goes boom, and Jews are killed, they're happy to go on the roof of the Allahu Akbar and have a couple of beers. So that's what was happening. And that was a bad thing. They're not allowed to drink beer. So we learned that if you don't destroy the warhead, you haven't done your job. So if that Katyusha warhead blows up in the north part of Ashkelon or the south part of Ashkelon, well, doesn't make a difference. We haven't done our job. We got to be effective against large amounts of rockets. The 1991 war was easy. That was batting practice. They throw a Scud at us, knock it out of the park. Throw another one, knock it out of the park. But you're going to see a movie in just a minute about 14 rockets that were launched simultaneously on Be'er Sheva. Now, we got to defend against, well, at least 14, even more, the bad guys coming in. And imagine we send up an interceptor that's going to shoot down a bad guy, and there are 14 of them coming in. And there's 14 bad guys, and there's 14 good guys going up, and there's explosions all over the place, and you got to hit particularly your guy, because if you hit the wrong guy, then your guy's going to leak through, and you can't hit your friend, and you look up in the sky, and the interceptors are saying in their computational minds, sure is a lot of metal up here, but then they got to find the right thing, and we do that all the time. We do that regularly. In fact, we've seen that our enemies are trying desperately to find soft spots in the system. And the first soft spot that even a person with single-digit IQ would think about is try throwing lots of stuff at them. So that's what they try, throwing lots of stuff at us, but we don't have any problems with that. That's not our soft spot. And I think our enemies are going to stop doing that and try finding other ways. Now, selective engagement is a nice way of saying that if there's a rocket that's going to fall in the ocean, we're going to let it fall in the ocean. We're not going to shoot it down because otherwise we'd be wasting money. Money. How much does one of your interceptors cost? I was asked. I said costs about, I don't know, in the order of magnitude of $100,000. Because people say it's 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, and the best number that I actually read when I was in Boston a month and a half ago, and I was standing in line in the supermarket reading the National Enquirer, who was talking about $95,000, and said, whoa, who leaked to the National Enquirer? So the National Enquirer is pretty close. So let's talk about 100. It's less than 100, but let's just say it's 100. It's okay, $100,000. How much do one of them Katyushas cost? Well, one of them Katyushas costs about $1,000. So he looks at me and he says, this is a congressman, by the way. He says, you won't tell me that you're trying to shoot down a $1,000 Katyusha with a $100,000 rocket? I said, no. He said, what do you mean? I said, because sometimes we use two of them. Because there's a bad guy coming in, and in the beginning, we weren't really sure it was going to work, so we were doing something called shoot. So we'd shoot two of our things, and we found out that the first one was always taking care of the bad guy, so why bother using the second one? But so he looks at me and he says, and he's not glassy-eyed here because this is a money sort of thing, you try and tell me, sir, that $1,000 they're shooting on you, and you're trying to shoot it down with $200,000? And I said, yes, sir. He said, and you call that affordable? And I said, yes, sir. He said, don't you Jewish people know a little bit about money? I said, said, yes, sir. So I said, tell me, sir, you're on the House Armed Services Committee. How much does a bullet for an M16 cost? He said, oh, I know how much that costs, about 25 cents. I said, really? I said, well, how much does a ceramic bulletproof vest cost? That cost about $6,500. I said, sir, do you want to tell me that in order to stop a 25-cent bullet, you're going to spend $6,500 on a bulletproof vest? He looks at me and says, I think we're going to have to take another look at the meaning of the word affordable. And here's the thing. In the last war, we defended a lot of rockets. Now, I can't give you numbers. Numbers are secret. I can tell you what it says in Wikipedia. According to Wikipedia, 1,500 rockets were fired at Israel. Out of those, 502 rockets were engaged by Iron Dome. Out of those, 432 were intercepted. And those numbers are interesting. I mean, they're not right, but they're interesting. And so let's say we did that 86% they're talking about. And let's say that there were about 200 rockets fired at Beersheba. And out of those 200 rockets, according to the 86%, about 170 of them were intercepted by Iron Dome. And let's say that those 170 rockets weren't intercepted by Iron Dome. Let's say Iron Dome wasn't in Beersheba. Let's say that those 170 rockets had hit their targets. Now, we will not engage unless we know that it's going to hit inside an urban area. So these targets, rockets, by definition, would have done damage. They would have hit buildings. They would have killed people. They would have caused damage, fires, cars exploding, world caving in. And what would have happened was that our newspapers, which our media, as opposed to Canadian media, our media suffers from something I like to call... I call them ethically challenged. These people have ethics that are somewhat different than mine, and these people would not hesitate to put pictures of fire and brimstone and funerals and blood on the front page of the newspaper for a couple of days running. And that would force the hand of the powers that be, and that would have started an incursion into Gaza. And it is absolutely 100% sure. Last week, I was in New York on Monday speaking at an event. Actually, it was in New Jersey, and the rabbi who was there said that he had just been speaking to a high political figure in Israel. He just came back, and the high political figure said, please go back and tell the Americans how glad we are that they supported Iron Dome, because if we didn't have Iron Dome, not only would we have gone into Gaza, would we have had to have gone into Gaza, but we would still be there. Because an incursion into Gaza, there's no such thing as a limited incursion. So, think for a second. How many civilian lives were saved in Beersheba? I don't know, tens. Statistically, based on the 2006 war, about 30. How many? But if we were to go into Gaza, then the soldiers, Israeli soldiers, would have been under threat. And we would have not escaped casualty-free. But the most insane thing is that who stood to lose the most? The people who stood to lose the most were the people who were firing these things at us in the first place. Because statistically, based on cast lead, for every Israeli soldier that dies in Gaza, there are close to 100 Gazans who die, most of them combatants. So we were saving the lives, Iron Dome was saving the lives of Israeli citizens. It was saving the lives of Israeli soldiers. It was saving the lives counterintuitively en masse of the people who were fighting against that and more. How much is a day of war in Gaza? A day of war in Gaza has been estimated at $250 million. That's $60 million for one day of war in Gaza. According to Wikipedia, we fired off 500 interceptors. Do a quick bit of math. 500 interceptors times $100,000 a pop, $50 million. In other words, according to this estimate over here, we spent less on all of the interceptors that we used in Iron Dome in the course of the 8-day war than we would have spent in one day of war in Gaza. But there's even more. We were deluged with letters from people that live in the south. And they said, you know what? We have something that we have not had in a really, really long time. In 10 years, we feel secure. we haven't had this feeling. What does it mean to feel secure? I'll tell you what it means to feel secure. No, the kids didn't go to school in Gaza, but yes, the shopping, not in Gaza, in Beersheba. But yes, the shopping malls were open. People went to the shuk. People went to weddings. I'll show you in just a minute a video from a wedding. You couldn't have done this if there was no Iron Dome. People would have been sequestered in their houses for 8 days. And they would have felt under siege. They're not under siege anymore. We have changed the way we, meaning Israel, has changed the way that people live. We've changed the way that we wage war. And we've changed the way that people live during times of war and during times of peace. We do indeed need to revisit the meaning of the word affordable. Okay, what is Iron Dome? Well, Iron Dome consists of pretty much what every single anti-aircraft or anti-missile system consists of. You got the interceptor over here. That's the pointy end of the stick. People always ask me, what does Tamir mean, a Tamir interceptor? Well, Tamir can mean one of two things. If you spell it with a taf, then it means a flowering date palm. Somewhat effeminate way to call an interceptor, but it keeps the enemy off guard. You can also spell it with a tet, Tamir, which means hidden or shielded, which is a good way to call Iron Dome. What Tamir really means, it comes from the acronym Til Miaret, which literally means interceptor. So the Tamir interceptor, literally translated, is the interceptor interceptor. Hence the reason we use the word Tamir and not interceptor interceptor, which looks like a typo. We have a fire control radar. That's the eyes of the system. We got to see the bad guy. We have a missile firing unit, which is really a launcher. This is holding interceptors in five packs. The interceptors come in five packs. We call them pitot. In each pita, you have five interceptors, and they go one on top of the other, and each launcher can hold up to 20 interceptors, up to four or five packs. And the interceptors are always in canisters. You don't see them unless they're launched. And this thing goes up almost vertically, so it can protect pretty much 360 degrees. A battery in Israel, you could have gone driven from Tel Aviv to Beersheba during the war and you would have seen all of the launchers because we didn't hide them. A battery in Israel is usually about two, three launchers. So defending a city at any given time right now is usually between 20 and 40 interceptors simultaneously. And if we run out, we reload. Battle Management Center, this is the most important part of the system, made by a company called Emprest, which is owned in part by Rafael. I think 50% owned by Rafael, 49% owned by Rafael. Battle Management Center contains what we rocket scientists refer to as the Yiddisher Kup. Now, this system works not because it's made of diamonds and rubies and gold and nuclear stuff. This system works because it's smart. This system has distilled the intelligence of countless engineers. And that's the real cool thing about it, because we can make the system better just by modifying software, just by modifying algorithms and stuff like that inside of it. So the Battle Management Center, its job is to analyze all the data and say, is there a bad guy coming? If the bad guy's coming, is he going to hit an area that I don't want him to hit? If he's going to hit that area, I got to defend against it. But I got a whole bunch of assets, so where should I launch an interceptor against it? From here, here, here. If I launch the interceptor from here, how should that, it's like a Talmudic game. If I should launch the interceptor from here, what kind of flyout should I do? And the interceptor's going to go like this, but I have to launch the interceptor at the right time. If I launch the interceptor too early, I'm going to miss the moving target. If I launch the interceptor too late, why launch it? It's going to miss anyway. Anyway, all of this Talmudic shakla vitaria, we call it in rocket science language, is going on in the Battle Management Center. And all of that is modified. We have modified the system seven times. We modified it online during the war, such that the system that is in operation now is head and shoulders better and more effective than the system that was in operation in April. And this causes a lot of people to talk about Iron Dome. And I used to look at Iron Dome in the... One of the things I like to do is I go into Google News every day, Google Iron Dome, and see what's going on. So there's a lot of stuff out there now because everybody likes talking about it because it's so, you know, it's a sexy system. There's really two kinds of articles that appear about any kind of defense system in the media, and Iron Dome is no different. Article number one is a leak. It's, you read the article and you say, oh my God, who told them? I mean, did he tell them? Did he accidentally tell them? No one's supposed to know this. It's secret. It's top secret. No one's supposed to know this. Article number two is complete and utter poppycock, balderdash, and such. And the neat thing is, you know, they'll tell you that Iron Dome is made of, it's made of rubber. Yes, it's a neat thing. It's made of rubber, and it actually bounces off the coming incoming missile. And it's ludicrous enough that people might actually believe it. And the problem is that it's kind of hard to distinguish between the two. So what I want to show you, the kind of things that I go through, is I'm going to show you, there's a slide package which is available over the internet, put together about this Israeli guy. He said, everything I know about Iron Dome, and this is all you need to know about Iron Dome. I'm going to show you some of it. Okay, here's what he says, things you should know. Here's what you need to know about Iron Dome. Number one, he says, each battery contains multiple launchers. Yes. He says over here, see this? He says, empty canister, interceptor most likely launched. Right. Either that interceptor was launched or that interceptor has gone for a cup of coffee and it will soon return. But what's problematic with this is it always leads you to believe there's two launchers here, there's two launchers here, there's two launchers here. And it leads you to believe the launchers are always next to each other, but they're not. There's not one base where Iron Dome is. The cool thing about Iron Dome is that it's based all over the place. All of the pieces of equipment talk to each other with a wireless network. So when we're defending Tel Aviv, we got one over here and one over here 10 kilometers away and another launcher over here 10 kilometers away. That's the neat thing about the system. It's small and it's spread out. So it doesn't serve as a target to the bad guys and say, Allahu Akbar, we are going to destroy Iron Dome. They're going to fire all these rockets. They're going to miss everything. The laser, remember that laser I was talking about? Big mother-sized thing. It's big enough so that it could serve as a target. This does not. Launcher, more things you should know. A full launcher contains 20 interceptors, but it might contain less in multiples of five. And he's 100% right. All he did was he went around the country and he took pictures of launchers. So you can see the amount of five packs. Here's one with 2 5 packs, here's one with 3 5 packs, and here's one with 4. Now, most of the stuff they say about the launcher is 100% true. Why? Because the launchers are out there. You can see them. You can walk very, very close to them, and you can watch them in action. So it's kind of difficult to make really bad mistakes about the launcher. Not so with the interceptor. Because like I said, the interceptor is sitting inside these things, and you don't see it until it's time to be launched. Now, whoosh, out it goes, and you don't see it. So it's kind of hard in that split second. Oh, I think I know what it is. It's kind of difficult to make these flash decisions. So here's what I like to know about the interceptor, and I'm going to read to you. Iron Dome interceptor have navigation fins on forward side next to the nose. These fins allow the interceptor to change course like the tail of an airplane. Everything he got from this slide about the interceptor is from this model of the interceptor that we sometimes send around. There's one of these interceptors is sitting in our petting zoo in Rafael. When you walk into the lobby, we have a petting zoo of there, nice little missile, and it's sitting there, and you can reach all these interesting conclusions, but guess what? This is not what the interceptor really looks like. So it's really cool that he gets these, and this is even better. Under the fins are exhaust tubes from the rocket motor that assist navigation. Really? I didn't know about that, and It's just so cool because if we have exhaust tubes, it means that we're like a totally different kind of system. And we got these Russian scientists scratching their heads saying, oh, I don't know what they are doing. And then, but it's totally wrong. And I love reading it. The aft fins are used primarily to stabilize the interceptor. No, we actually use the aft fins to go tell the enemy that we are coming. There's a whole bunch of stuff here that they will never know about. The moral of the story is that if you don't see something, don't write about it. He didn't see something, and he did try writing about it. So what you're going to read about the interceptor in the newspaper is most predominantly wrong. And here's where we get to the videos. Now, these two videos are off of YouTube, but I can tell you what's going on, whereas YouTube cannot. This is from March 2012. This is from Ashkelon. Now, what you're going to see is that this is going to fire. It's up at almost 70 degrees. It's going to fire off an interceptor. We're going to track the interceptor with the camera. And it's going to actually fire off another interceptor that you can't see because we're tracking the first one. What is wrong with this video? I'll tell you what's wrong with this video. My boss gets really angry at me for showing it. He says, this video is readily available on YouTube. What are you going to show them that they don't already know? what is amazing about this video is that it was taken at all. This video was taken with an iPod, with an iPhone. When you hear the siren, you go into a closed room. You go into a mamad. You go into an interior room of a house. But they don't do that anymore. There's a sound and light show going on up there. God Almighty Himself is coming to save us. Hityatzvu ur'u et yeshuat Hashem. Stand tall and watch Kadosh Baruch Hu save you. Fine. That's a very bad thing. Very, very bad thing. And I'll get into that for a second. But watch how this thing moves. And I'll give you an idea of how Iron Dome works while we're doing it. Whoops. No. Don't look. Don't look. Oh, come on. So how about those Mets? Just a second here. Bring that up. Oh, I don't believe this. Okay, on a mark, get set, go. That's the siren. Get up. Up goes the interceptor. What the interceptor does is it tries to hit the target head on. You're going to see this thing do a turn, perform a turn, which is unbelievable. It's going to perform almost a 180-degree turn. Watch this thing. We're still zoomed in. There's another interceptor in the air following this thing. Woo! The rocket motor burns out. You're going to see two explosions. Watch carefully. There it is. Boom, boom. There were two explosions. One explosion was the explosion of the interceptor and the Katyusha that we destroyed. The second explosion was the explosion of the second interceptor. One of the things that we are most pedantic about in our system is safety. And we have a very, very comprehensive self-destruct mechanism in there. We will never allow a live interceptor to land yonder because Israel is so small. As soon as that second interceptor knows that the first interceptor intercepted, then we will send it a signal, all right, your services are not needed, thank you very much, and it destroys itself. And that is how Iron Dome works. But here is the rub. Here's what it looked like in Defensive Pillar. Everybody loves taking pictures. Everybody's taking pictures. They're readily available with the flowers in the background. They're just starting to bloom. My personal favorite is the Haredi kid watching the video. They always got pictures of a Haredi person watching the video. And this makes the people at my work happy. They say like this. How do you say Iron Dome in Hebrew? Kippat Barzel. In Hebrew, Kippat Barzel. What's Kippat Barzel mean? It means a kippah made of iron. And it bugs the hell out of people at my work that there are certain people who erroneously think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is any way at all involved in the saving of lives. And they say, ha, 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 you don't need a kippah like this kid's wearing. You have the Kippat Barzel. Ha, ha, ha. And I say, well, what about me? I got both of them. And I say, ha, ha, ha. At any rate, there's a video I was just passed 2 days ago, and it was passed to me by my boss, and he's seriously angry about this video. There's the owner and proprietor of Emprest is a religious Jew. And one of the things he does, he gives a shir and daf yomi every day at work. It's a nice place to work, Empress. And in the beginning of one of his shirs, which was caught on tape, he attributed the success of Iron Dome to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If you can imagine. So that really peeved the powers that be at Raphael, and I received this email, how dare they, how dare they, and I'm thinking, yeah, it was. So here's something that a video here that is completely and entirely insane. It shows a reality that we live in Israel that is very, very hard for people to get their heads around outside of Israel. What you see here is a wedding in Beersheba, which would not have been happening were there not Iron Dome. And it's not a religious wedding. You hear the clinking of glasses and you can hear the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And you can almost see the chassan and kala dancing in there, whatever. And all this, you hear the siren go off. And what are these people going to do when the siren goes off? They're going to take pictures. Because at night, the sound and light show is even better. You're going to see big things in the sky. And you're going to see a fly. What happened was our buddies in Gaza chose that time to fire 14 rockets almost simultaneously into Beersheba. Try to overload the system, as it were. Two of these things landed yonder. So we didn't try shooting them down. 12 of them were going to land in Beersheba proper. One of them is going to land almost near here. They didn't know about that. They were all destroyed. Watch this. It's unbelievable.
What?
Cruiser Interceptors. Those are the rocket motors. Boom, boom, boom. Another 3-4 bite the dust. Look at the bottom left. That's the kind of reality that we live in. And that's a horrible reality, and I'll tell you why. Because, you know what? I'll tell you why in just a minute. I briefed somebody named Barry Schrag from Boston, a very influential person who's very friendly with Sheldon Nettleson and gets him to donate a lot of stuff. And Barry Schrag came together with some professor from Brandeis. And after I finished briefing them, professor pulls me aside and says, you know, you guys got a big problem. I said, really? He said, Iron Dome is killing your efforts for Hasbara, for trying to plead your cause to the general public. I said, how? He said, well, there's a limit to how many times people can show Iron Dome going up and shooting down bad guys, and you guys simply haven't sustained casualties. So we got no casualties on the Israeli side. We got lots of casualties on their side. We got dead babies and children, and in fact, one of the babies in brackets was killed by an errant Qassam, which was actually launched on Israel. But you're trying, you can't plead your case in front of these people because they're getting all the sympathy because they got all the blood. And I thought, how grotesque. You need me to offer up Jews on the altar of just to say that, hey, our situation is just as bad as you are? I mean, what kind of person would ever ask me to do that? And then the next day I read a similar article on the internet by David Hurwitz, and I thought, we got a big problem. Because if our own side is saying we have a Hasbara problem because we don't have dead people, because we're saving them, then we have to find a way to plead our case. And I thought about something that Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah once said in 2006 when they were fighting us. And he said, you know, we will defeat you. We will eventually defeat you. You know why? Because you worship life, and we worship death, and we will one day defeat you. But then I thought, you know what? My son, Amichai, he was in Course Makim. It's a commander's course in the army, and his commander told him something, which I had heard elsewhere, but it's nice to hear Amichai say it. He said, Abba, my commander told me, he said that the Hamas wants to die for what they believe in. And our job is to help them. Hamas worships death. We don't. So I said, let's try doing a bit of Hasbara, celebrating life and not death. I sit in a room with a woman named Ilana. Ilana gets all of the data from the last war. And she knows exactly where all of the incomings were going to hit were they not shot down. Because we know where they're going to hit. If they're going to hit inside the area we have to defend, we'll shoot it down. Otherwise, we won't. I said, do me a favor, Ilana. Give me all those points where they're going to hit, and I'll do something with them. So I got all the points, all these coordinates, and I fired up my computer, and I shtooped them in there, and I put them on Google Maps. And there they are sitting on Google Maps. Now, Israel is kind of slow in Google Maps. Not everywhere in Israel has street view in Google Maps, but some places do. So I found some of the points that the rockets would have landed, and I put them in street view to give you an idea what these places would have looked like. So here's a picture here of Ben-Gurion University in the Negev, where a rocket would have landed, with all the nice bikes over here. And here's a factory near Ashdod. Here's Main Street in Ashkelon. It would have been a rocket that fell here and one that fell over there next to that pole. Here is an apartment in southern Tel Aviv on the border of Chulon. And if you're to go to these places today, they will look exactly the same because people in Israel have given everything they have to develop a system whose purpose is to keep them looking this way. And I would think, what does that professor want from me? Does he want me to show pictures like this These pictures are superimposed pictures from 2006, when we did not have Iron Dome, when we did not have anything to defend against. This is what it looks like when you don't have anything defending. You want cars burning? You want factories down? You want dead people? You want apartment buildings that are destroyed? We don't want that. We have something else. We have a better way of living. We have something that will allow us a better way of life. We don't celebrate death. An Iron Dome is a way that Israelis have given Israelis a way to celebrate life. And I think that there is no better hasbara than just these beautiful pictures of a very, very nice life in Israel. But there is a rub. And the rub is that Iron Dome is becoming deified. People are bowing down to the God of Iron Dome. And these are things that just I took off the JP, Jerusalem Post. Who do we thank for Iron Dome? Technion graduates whose brain power, skills, and talents are honed through the Technion experience. Advancing technology to protect Israel. Learn more. When you click this button, you'll realize that David, who's the chief engineer of Iron Dome, went to Beersheba University in the Negev. Coca-Cola, the official refreshing drink of Iron Dome. Eged buses taking Iron Dome scientists home at the end of the day. And you have Angry Birds, Kippat Barzel edition over here. And you got your little Angry Bird over here shooting down a rocket. You got your little Vincent van Gogh kind of sunflower painting over here. I don't know what insane chakala would stand on a wedding day next to this symbol over here. I don't know. And here's the sheep, a very pastoral Iron Dome. And people think that Iron Dome is going to save everybody's life. Iron Dome has been woven into the book of Halacha. How so? Law is, when a person is praying, when he's davening, and he's in the middle of Shmona Esrei, that when he hears an alarm go off, he is supposed to stop doing what he's doing and save his life and go into a bomb shelter. Saith the chief rabbi of Ashdod, no more. There is no more fear that you will be hit by a rocket because we got Kippat Barzel up there. If you hear something going on, you may continue your davening. Let me tell you a story of what happened the second day of the war. I got to work 8 o'clock in the morning, and there were already rumors that a house in Kiryat Malachi had been hit by Katyusha. And I was talking to Ophir, who's an engineer. He's the chief engineer of the Interceptor. And I said to Ophir, boy, thank God we're not in Kiryat Malachi, because that's the last thing I need on my conscience. He said, we are in Kiryat Malachi. I said, what happened? He said, we didn't engage. I said, why? He said, you know all those components back there that I showed you? Well, they all talk to each other, and they all talk to each other in this communication internet sort of thing. And I'm certain there are people here who've had the horrible experience of their internet being down. I think there's anybody who hasn't had that experience. Well, on that particular day, at that particular time, our internet was down. So we didn't engage. And the rocket came in to the porch where these people were standing to watch the salvation of God. And it killed them. And you know what? These people didn't have to die. And I'll tell you why. A Katyusha rocket, when it comes in, it has a switch called a crush switch on the nose, such that when the Katyusha hits a solid wall, it explodes. It explodes and its warhead explodes. Now, our dear buddies in Gaza like to coat their warheads with all sorts of goodies, like ball bearings and marbles and screwdrivers, screws and stuff like that, just to increase the killing effect. Well, had these people been even in an interior room, that Katyusha would have hit the wall. All of that fichsa would have been spewed outside the wall. They would have taken blasts, because blasts would have come in, but they might have lived. What happened was that these people were on an open porch standing watching. The Katyusha came into the porch and exploded onto the porch, and it sprayed all of the shrapnel right there and then on their bodies, and they were killed in the most horrible way. Don't put that on me. I work on a system whose job is to shoot down interceptors. And we will shoot down rockets. And we will shoot down rockets. To the best of our ability, we will shoot down rockets. But we're not God. And don't turn me into God. I'm not going to save your life. You're going to save your life. You're going to use my help, and you're going to use the help of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and you're going to do what you need to do to save your life. But people aren't doing that anymore. And that's something that I can't have on my shoulder. My life is difficult enough as it is without having to bear the burden of the lives of all these people who've decided that Iron Dome is going to save them from everything. And so my personal request to everybody sitting in this room is, if one day you are in Israel and one day you hear that alarm go off, please stand up, think about what I'm saying to you now, and go into a bomb shelter, go into an interior room of the house, and you save your life. I was on the Hill last year, on Capitol Hill last year, and one of the congressmen asked me, he said, how many of these things do we need? Because Congress has given a lot of funding to this, which we'll talk about in the last slide. How many of these do we need? And I said, I deflected the question. Fortunately, I was briefing. Standing next to me was the military attaché from the Ministry of Defense, and he fielded the question. He said, well, you know, the official request from Israel is somewhere between, hoping to have between 13 and 15 batteries. So the first thought that went through my mind was kind of an egotistical thought, because each battery defends a city. One battery, one city. There's a battery in Ashdod, a battery in Beersheba. One battery, one city. And you thought, you know, I live in a little place in the middle of nowhere called Moreshet, and there's not going to be a battery that's defending me. And it's kind of, surreal that someone who's actually developed this thing is not being saved by this thing. But then I thought about it even more, and I thought, this is ludicrous. 13 to 15? How many cities are there in Israel? We can start going around this room, 100 people here. And how many cities are there in Israel? 30, 40, 50, 60. Add to that army bases we got to protect. Add to that airports, air force bases, ports of call on the side of Israel. Strategic locations such as between Tel Aviv and Haifa. There's two huge smokestacks which are providing electricity for everybody north of Netanya. I don't want those whacked by a Katyusha. What happens then? So when people ask me now at AIPAC, how many do we need? We need to lobby our congressman. How many do we need? I say we need 23. No, 39. No. 57. 124. We will never have enough of these things. The fact that they work makes them all that much more precious. But we will never have enough of these things. And that's where the support, not as much of the Canadians, because you guys haven't given us that much money, is the United States. Now, Iron Dome was developed. How much money did the United States spend to develop Iron Dome? Don't bother. The answer is zero. The United States did not spend one red cent in order to develop Iron Dome. We tried to entice them into it. They were uninterested. But the United States has become interested in helping support Israel by procuring Iron Dome. By procuring, I mean by helping us to buy Iron Dome batteries. So in 2011, we had $205 million that was added to the budget. That was eventually slashed to $203 million. The House Armed Services Committee allocated another $680 million this year. That was immediate, out of that money, $70 million was immediately added to the 2012 budget, and the rest, the other $610 million, will be given to Israel over the next 3 years, about $200 million a year. Now, what the Americans didn't understand was, the people that I've been speaking to in AIPAC, what they didn't understand was that we're not building these batteries and then we're going to field them. The way we field batteries is we build the stuff. Stuff is coming off the line all the time. We don't stop building interceptors. The interceptors are coming off the line, and some of these interceptors were built with American funding. So what it really means is that in the last war, American funding, the generosity of the American taxpayer and of the American government, say what you want, the American government saved lives. The American Congress, the President of the United States, saved Israeli lives, and it bothered me. What bothered me? It bothered me that people in Israel have easier time saying, please give me, than they have saying, thank you. And hakarat hatov, recognizing goodness, recognizing that someone has done kindness to you, is not as evident in our national DNA as it should be. And what I did was I wrote a letter to some friends of mine at AIPAC. And I said, I'm just writing this letter as Ari Sasher, as an Israeli. I'm not writing it as a Rafael person. Someone got a hold of this letter and put it in the CJN with my name associating me with Rafael, and that kind of bothered me. But that has since been excised from the internet. But this is what I wrote to AIPAC, and I said like this. You guys have to understand something. We worked very, very hard on Iron Dome, and there are people that gave everything they had. And I gave an example of a friend of mine named Amir, and Amir is an engineer. And I was supposed to sit with Amir on Thursday morning, the second day of the war. And I said to him, you know, Amir, let's sit down. It's in our outlook right now. And the outlook never lies, like the National Enquirer. And we have to sit down. We have to talk. Because there was a test that we ran, and I have to prepare a brief for the Missile Defense Agency. They're monitoring all the cash flow now that comes from America. And Amir said, can't go. I got to run. Got to build a battery in Tel Aviv. I said, what? You're going to build and defend Tel Aviv now? I mean, it's going to take you weeks to put up a battery. You know that. He says, well, we think we're going to be able to put it up in less time. And they told me to defend Tel Aviv, and so we did. So I met him on Sunday. Came back to work. Friday and Shabbos, we don't work in Israel. I came back to work on Sunday, and Amir's there. I said, Amir, how are you doing? Fine. When did you finish? Did you finish the battery? And I was kind of thinking, no. He said, yes, we did. I said, really? He said, yeah, we finished it yesterday, Shabbos afternoon at 1:30. I said, how did they let you work on Shabbos? He says, you don't understand. When I saw you on Thursday, we worked 48 hours straight to get that battery up in Tel Aviv. We didn't eat. We didn't sleep. We didn't see our family. We didn't shower. We didn't change our clothing. Friday night when Shabbos came in, you got to understand that these people that worked on it with Amir are not religious. We stopped what we were doing. We made Kiddush at least to say, hey, this is a special day. This is Shabbos now, and we kept on working. 1:30 in the afternoon, on Shabbos afternoon, the battery was up. At 4:30 in the afternoon, on Shabbos afternoon, the Gazans fired a Fajr 5 at Tel Aviv. That Fajr 5 was engaged and shot down by the battery that was set up by Amir and his friends, who gave everything they had. They gave their family, they gave their lives, they gave everything to stand up for the people of Israel. And I said that you guys in America are just the same. You don't understand it. Today, right now, there are people that are walking around in Tel Aviv, and they're taking their kids to school, and they're learning Torah with their grandchildren, and they're sitting watching at a theater, a movie right now. And these people are alive and breathing only because of the generosity of the United States government and its citizens. They don't know who they are. They don't know who you are. And unfortunately, no one has really said thank you. And from the bottom of my heart, I want to tell you, and I want you to pass this message on to anybody you know. And this message is very, very simple. Thank you. And may that be the message of this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, really, for a very powerful and moving talk. We'll take a few questions. The evening's a little late, or whatever. We'll do a round of questions. We'll ask you to speak into the microphone. If you can come up, one after another, keep the questions under 30 seconds, please, and a question, and then Ari can answer them in one go-around.
How many nerve centers are there? Is there only one, or are there separate?
What question again?
How many nerve centers are there?
Yes. Any other questions?
Where do you keep your weapons?
Yes.
I can ask?
Yes, please.
Okay. As there's this ceasefire that happened, since this ceasefire, are they throwing rockets into northern Israel?
No.
No. Good.
There's been nothing. It's been very, very quiet since the ceasefire.
Can you say something?
David Sling. Okay, David Sling is a program that's also being developed by Rafael. I spent 4 years on David Sling managing Raytheon. David Sling is a system that sits above Iron Dome. Iron Dome takes care of the dumb stuff, takes care of the stuff up to a Fodger. If it's coming in and it's fired from further than 75 kilometers out, then it's going to be coming in too high and too fast for Iron Dome to take care of. So David Sling is there to take care of those Scuds that are coming in from Syria and those cruise missiles that are coming in from Iran. And above David Sling, there's another system, and that's called Arrow. And Arrow takes care of the Shihabs and Sigils that are coming in from Iran. And above Arrow 2, there's another system called Arrow 3, which is in development that'll take care of even longer-range rockets. What we have in Israel is what's called a multi-layer missile defense. In Hebrew, multi-layer missile defense, which is protecting everybody. We have this control center, which is actually being developed to merge all of these pieces together. It's like the two all-beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, and a sesame seed bun. So we got all these layers here that if you don't put on the special sauce, then it's not merged. So we're putting it all together so that we know what's coming from where and where we need to engage and which whistle and that we're working on right now. Any other questions?
Wonderful system, wonderful presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Your comment about the Hasbara, though, unfortunately, from the point of view of those of us outside of North America, and we spend a lot of time in Europe, is very necessary. It really is, and David Horowitz made a very good point. I hate to say it, but for the rest of the world's media, for The Guardian, for the BBC, there are not enough Jews being killed.
I'm sorry.
It's a real problem.
I'm sorry.
It's a real problem that the rest of us have to deal with in the rest of the world.
I wish that I could help you, but I can't.
And I don't want your help. I don't want you to help. What I'm saying is that it's something that we do need to recognize. Not for you to hold back in your efforts at all.
I can't.
But
feel
we need
that
to
question.
Know about it. The rest of the world takes that point.
Tough. Any other questions?
I came to thank you for the presentation.
Thank you.
And I think you should be healthy and continue your work, that you can sit here and listen and enjoy our life here in Canada and we help whatever we can.
Thank you.
This is the finish of my question. I don't want to hold you up. I have some sources that I got news about Israel. Jerusalem Post, Jerusalem magazine, the internet, this internet, that internet, DEPCA file.
Mm-hmm.
I read the internet, and they say, in Israel, they invented a laser beam. The laser beam goes up, and the missile or the airplane, chick, cuts it up.
Yeah, I spoke about that. I spoke about that laser beam. The laser beam's great, but it doesn't work when it's raining.
Yeah, but I come and say to my friends,
mm-hmm.
They say, Itzik, are you crazy? Where did you hear that? I didn't see that. I hear that. They think how boys get trapped from cop.
It's there. Tell him I said so. Let's take a couple more, and Zell.
Yes, you mentioned that.
How come women don't ask questions? It's always guys that ask questions.
You mentioned that Israel is a great debt to the Americans.
Yes.
I would suggest that the Americans owe a greater debt to Israel. There's a person, an Israeli-American named Abram Kassem. He's the father of the unmanned drone. He was profiled 3 weeks ago in The Economist magazine, and the American magazine Foreign Policy called him one of the top 100 global thinkers. Abram Kassem, who invented the unmanned drone, was originally
a
designer for the Israeli Air Force. Now he lives in the United States. He enabled the Americans under President Obama to wipe out much of the al-Qaeda leadership. And not only that, he saved lots of American lives with this unmanned drone in Pakistan, Yemen, and Afghanistan.
True.
So when you say that Israel is a debt to Americans, there's also a debt that the Americans owe to Israel.
Absolutely. I'm not saying that America doesn't owe Israel, but what I'm saying is that the credit should be given where credit is due. And in this case, credit is due, and credit should be given. Ina chinami, that the countries have helped each other out a lot. We've helped America way above and beyond just drones. there's a lot of Israeli stuff floating around in the U.S. Air Force that's done a lot of damage to Al-Qaeda, and then there's other civilian stuff. Michael Oren every once in a while writes an article reminding people that Israel is not just a country that takes. I agree with you 100%. My point was that in this particular situation, credit hadn't been given yet. Next question.
The Iron Dome can determine where the missile is going to land.
Yes. Yes, it can determine where it was
shot
from. That's
right. Now, it can determine where it came from as well. So yes. why don't you respond in real time to that location?
Why don't we?
Respond and target the location where it came from.
How come you're not wearing socks? I don't know that you're not wearing socks, just the way you don't know that we can't target that location.
I know. I think you can, but we haven't heard about it.
Sorry, forgot to tell you. Wait, you're standing in line. Hey, hello. Yes.
First of all, thank you.
Thank you.
Secondly, how prepared do you think Israel is for protecting the country against war with Hezbollah? And the second part is, what about protecting against gas attack from Syria?
Against Hezbollah, we got Iron Dome. So, just how many?
Because they have a huge, much huger missile battery.
Yeah. We just need more Iron Domes. Very simple. I mean, according to the papers today, we got five of them. Pick five cities in the north. We want to defend. Everybody else dies. But the question is make no mistake about it. We're producing these things as fast as we possibly can, with the help from the Americans, and more money has been given by the Ministry of Defense to produce more. And these are coming off the assembly lines as we speak. Against a Syrian attack, we would use Arrow at this point in time. And what we should be using is David Sling. David Sling won't be operational until 2014. So this time we'd use Arrow. Here's the big problem. If we use Arrow, even if we use David Sling, these things intercept when the rockets that are being fired at us are still yonder on the other side of the border. And there's all sorts of, if you hit a chemical weapon, there's going to be chemicals that come out. And whatever hits the ground, I mean, it's going to hit the ground, and it may very well do damage to the people that are living on the other side. And you heard it here first. But when these things are fired and when they're shot down, and when those people and civilians in Syria or Lebanon are killed by gas fired by Syria, they're going to blame us for it. Guaranteed. Please.
Hi, awesome presentation and awesome system. I also live in Israel. I like that you made the point that it's maybe not the panacea, that we shouldn't develop a false sense of security with this. We should still go into our mamads and not just stand there and continue doing what we were doing. That was very important, and I'm glad you said that. But you also said that because of the system, so we didn't have to go into Gaza. And I want to know, don't you think that's sort of just solving the, like treating the symptom without trying to solve the problem?
Wouldn't it be counterintuitive if because we had Iron Dome, we didn't go into Gaza because we didn't have the need to go into Gaza, but as a result, we actually perpetuated war because we haven't stopped the flow of rocket fire into Gaza. Fortunately, I don't make these decisions. We just provide the system, and I can guarantee you that people will be writing about the effects of having a working missile defense system on political and military decisions for years to come. Absolutely, what you say is absolutely correct. Maybe right, maybe wrong, I don't know. But definitely food for thought, and it'll provide food for thought for a lot of people for a number of years.
Thanks.
Let's take two more questions, and Zell.
If the Arrow or David Sling system doesn't succeed in shooting down a long-range missile, will the Iron Dome still try to shoot it down?
I can't hear. I got problems with this here. Can I have the next question, please?
What about sabotaging of the batteries? Because they're out in the open?
One of the things that we're worried about, obviously, is the fact that there's so much communication networks. We're worried about computer security. But there are people that work on this system that their sole job is computer security, just to make sure that no one tries feeding something into the system that will cause the internet, as it were, to go down. Defending these batteries is easier than you would think because they're so small and they're spread out. And they're not really a target. So what we do is you put a fence around the components, and that keeps the people out. But everybody can see them in Israel. You saw pictures of people looking at them. And people in Tel Aviv used to go down to a hill overlooking where one of the launchers was just to watch it. So
you wouldn't have somebody walk in there with a bomb or... I'm talking about on the ground.
Yeah. You can't because they're surrounded. They're military areas and you won't be able to get close. You get a couple of hundred meters away, you're going to have a rough time. Unless you're carrying a rocket with you, you won't have an easy time. Even if you have a rocket with you, you're not going to hit it because the rockets are so imprecise. So the answer is yes, they are very well defended.
Those Katyushas and Fedja rockets that go past the cities and are not shot down, they land on the land or in the sea. What kind of damage do they cause environmentally, and are they still dangerous?
They're probably still dangerous, yeah. If they land in the sea and they come up on the shore, they're still dangerous. But we are not going to spend $100,000 trying to save the environment when that $100,000 is better used in saving lives. So there is definitely give and take. I mean, some people ask me, how about the debris? And yes, there's debris, and what will the debris do to the environment? I don't know. What will the debris do to the people? We make sure that we fire these things so that they're shot down such that the debris is not over the defended area. Sometimes we can't do that, and the debris falls. I mean, when the Fajr 5, the first one was fired at Tel Aviv, it was broken into pieces, and a big chunk hit a car and set the car on fire. And that's kind of unfortunate. But had a big Fajr 5 hit the car, then the owner would not be here right now today to complain. So there, we try to do as best we can. We have concerns, but that's not one of our highest concerns. Last question?
It was reported in the media this week that Iskander rockets or missiles can get through all of the multi-layers. Are there other weapons that the bad guys have that will be able to get through all of our layers of defense once they're in place?
I can't discuss this with you. Are there any other questions that I can discuss with you? If not, thank you very much. What? One last question. All right, fine. See if I care. So I'll go to sleep later. I don't care.
Well, I also want to thank all those American investors who put tens of billions of dollars in all those Israeli companies and the little companies like Microsoft and Oracle who have really driven the software that's helped you to get where you are. But this is my question. Why is the media neglecting to cover the next generation U.S. technology like EMP and drones that are laser and proven in all conditions, yet focusing constantly on Iran's potential capability to build a nuclear war? I mean, in a low-level confrontation, this stuff is great. But if we ever face a major conflict, which may unfortunately happen, the U.S. is the country that has these technologies that will be able to defend Israel and really make everything obsolete. It's like 1945.
So you're asking why the media
is
not talking
about
them?
In 1945, nobody believed that America had the atomic bomb. Even the Emperor of Japan didn't believe it after the first one fell. But it made the rest of the world's military hardware supply totally obsolete.
So my answer to your question would be that I personally haven't the faintest idea. I'm just not in the media. I don't know. It's a valid complaint.
Because we're losing a psychological war, believing that Iran has the edge when they really don't. Tough. If you really look at what America has today, they've got this EMP technology. Boeing just came out with a proven test a couple months ago. There was just something 2 weeks ago, this new laser drone that can take out. I mean, we're so far ahead, yet we're fearful.
I don't know the answer, would that I did. All right, Zell, thank you very, very much.
Okay.
Good evening.
I just want to express Hakarta Toftari, wish him and the Siyat Tova. He's going back to Israel after a very hectic week to his wife and 8 children. And thank you very much. And everybody, Shavua Tov. Thank you.